Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Which one is that? That's the second time it's gone off.
They never go home, those boys.
The second captain's
world service.
And I said, I want to win the league, but I want to win it better. You can understand that, can't you?
Yes.
Good lad.
So he's almost like having a second captain in the team.
Second captain, first captain, whatever.
There are lots of amazing Pelé stories going around today, but I think the coolest by a distance comes from our friend Fionn Davenport. Listen to this one. I was in school with Pelé's son, Edson, in New York in the late 70s, and the great man came to our house a couple of times to pick him up after birthday parties. He played football with us and showed us how to take a penalty, and I'll never forget my father's face when he met his hero. I mean, Fionn, you could have given us this information when we were deciding who to take the penalties in our penalty shootout in the semi-final of the 2017 Fair Play Cup, but listen, that's probably for another day. You're welcome to the Second Captain's Football Podcast. Yesterday at 3:27 p.m. local time, a statement from a Sao Paulo hospital confirmed the death of the great Pelé, our dear king of football, as he's described in the statement. There's a ton of amazing footage going around the last 24 hours. You should check out the video we tweeted of Pelé playing for Santos in Dalymount Park in 1972. Mark used a number of shots from that one in our opening sequence for our TV show a few years back. The Pelé did it first video, I don't know how, I haven't seen it, it's got about 30 million views. I hadn't seen it before, it just shows a load of different footballers over the years pulling off various tricks and then splicing them together with Pelé doing those tricks in the first place many years before. That was the nub of Erling Haaland's tribute. Everything you see any player doing, Pelé did it first, RIP, said Haaland. Interestingly, for somebody who scored approximately, let's just give him the 1,281 goals for now. For somebody who scored 1,281 goals, if the initial tributes are anything to go by, his most revered moment on a football pitch is a chance he missed.
Can only but feel that justice has been done. Costal. Pelé streaking away. There's a beautiful pass for him. He's round the goalkeeper. Just let him run on. And he scores. No!
I've seen that dummy and the Uruguay goalkeeper at the 1970 World Cup pop up all over the place since yesterday's news, way more than any of Pelé's many, many goals. And certainly for sheer audacity, it was a hell of a moment. Coincidentally, by the way, today's show was supposed to be about the new Ronaldo documentary, the Brazilian Ronaldo, possibly the closest Brazil has come to producing another Pelé. But with the news of Pelé's passing, we'll hold that Ronaldo chat till next week. And instead today, we are reposting a conversation Ken had with Tim Vickery last year. This was around the release of the Pelé documentary on Netflix. So thank you so much for your support of the show. Do have a happy, what are we at, December 30th now? So have a happy new year. We'll have a brand new pod for you on Monday, our first one of 2023, about all the football happening over the next few days. Until then, enjoy Tim Vickery on Pelé.
As long as there's some.
I'm lost for words, really. I'm over the moon. Emotional. It's unbelievable.
It's Stuttgart. It's New Jersey. They're all rolled into one. Another big, big scalp when it was needed most. Lyon, here we come.
Tim Vickery, great to talk to you as always.
My pleasure. Let's kick the ball around talking about one of the all-time greats. Why not?
Well, if I gave you the following quote, I've never thought I was better than anybody else. I'm lucky I was brought up with these values. Would you recognize these instantaneously as the words of the great Pelé?
No, I wouldn't. I know a lot of people like to talk about his humility, how humble he is. And it's true and it's false. People are complex and they're contradictory. One of the first people who saw what he was going to be is a Brazilian. He was a dramatist called Nelson Rodriguez, but he's probably Brazil's most important football writer, as well as being a leading playwright. Right from the start, he was the first one to call Pelé the king. This is before the 58 World Cup. And one of the things that he identified in Pelé, the player and the person, was an absolute lack of all humility. you ask him after the game, who was the best on the field? And he'll say, I was. Nelson Rodriguez saw this as an immense virtue and as was something capable of changing Brazil. And I think Pelé did that. Just a little bit of context here. And remember that in the 1920s, science itself was racist. The idea of different races having different characteristics was science itself at that time. Now, Brazil had a multiracial football team, and there were ideas of innate inferiority in them in football. In 1950, the World Cup in 1950 on home ground, great side, but they lose it just at the end of the final minutes of the final game against Uruguay. Oh, no, we're bottle boys. We'll never amount to anything. We're inferior. 1954, they go and play the great Hungarians in the quarterfinal. And before the game, they're whipped up into a mad patriotic fervor. They're told to go out and avenge Brazil's deaths in the Second World War. Quite what Hungary had to do with that, no one really knows. They all kissed the flag and they went out and they kicked the crap out of the Hungarians in the Battle of Bern. But at least they hadn't bottled it, you know, but still, oh, we've crumbled under the pressure and so on. Those ideas of innate mongrel inferiority on the football field die in 1958, and Pelé is a big part of the reason for that.
I mean, it's the point about his absolute lack of humility is hilarious, because in this film, you know, he repeatedly affects like a almost ostentatious modesty. You know, like, I've never believed there is in such a thing as the best player in the world. To be the best player in the world, you need to be better than everyone in every position, you know, and that's tricky. I mean, he also reveals that he told his father, his grieving father in 1950, who's just seen Brazil lose to the World Cup final, and he's like 10-year-old, 9-year-old or whatever age he is at the time, and he says, don't worry, Dad, I'll win the World Cup for you. So he's got a little bit of ego going on, but it's as though what struck me about it was this is obviously the way he thinks he should behave, like with total modesty. It's not like a case of, you know, I'm the greatest. That it seems like that was not really the way to go on in Brazil of Pelé's time.
Well, it comes out from time to time. And I remember going into the 2006 World Cup, it seems either sad or ridiculous to think this at the time, but going into the 2006 World Cup, it was common to believe that this was going to be the tournament when Ronaldinho proved that he was better than Pelé. I remember that being a headline on a big Brazilian magazine. At the end of Brazil's first game, it was a narrow win over Croatia, Pelé could hardly wait to get across to the Brazilian press and say that Ronaldinho had been the worst player on the field. you know, and he, he's, he is immensely proud of his legacy. So he should be. You don't build up a legacy like Pelé without a fair little bit of ego along the way. Ever since he hung up his boots, one of his priorities has been protecting that legacy. I think part of this, Ken, is a story of the failings of journalism. Because the press, too much that was written about him was hagiography. And even for me, the greatest, my inspiration, Hugh McElvanney, wrote pieces about Pelé where, you know, he concludes everything about him is great. There was too simple a kind of dichotomy built up between, you know, Pelé the good guy and Maradona the bad guy. And what we've seen just in recent years is a kind of generational rebellion against Pelé, with younger generation thinking, firstly, what did he actually do on the field? Who did he do it against? And secondly, well, he's a bit of a square, isn't he? You know, the younger generation responding more to the kind of spontaneous rebellion of a Maradona rather than the calculated being with the system of Pelé. And so there's been, I think, something of a generational backlash against him. I think the excellent thing about this documentary and the debate about Pelé is there's now a chance to humanize him, to work out that this isn't what even Hugh McElvanney, even the great Hugh McElvanney was writing, you know, this almost paragon of virtue. There's a human being there, you know, and a human being with extraordinary drive, because you don't become as great as Pelé was, and he was unbelievably great. He was a machine for playing football, but you don't become that great without having an almost insane, almost mentally unhealthy drive within you. Now, I see Pelé as almost the perfect synthesis of his parents. There are two motivating forces in life, I think, and one is pride and the other is fear. And he had both of them so strong. The pride came from his dad, who was a very, very good footballer and took immense pride in being a good footballer and had a nice, easygoing nature and a lovely smile about him. You see aspects of that in Pelé. The fear comes from his mum. Now, his mum was a very, very strong character at a time when, for married women, there are almost no avenues for that strength to be expressed. And a lot of that strength becomes expressed in a fear of being unable to provide, fear of poverty. And when Pelé's father suffers a serious injury on his what should be his big break as a footballer, and it plunges the family into a poverty without hope, that's a defining moment in his life as well, because then in order to become a footballer, He has to overcome all of the maternal resistance, because this is a time when there's not a great deal of money in the game. You know, some of the Brazil's biggest name players are signing blank contracts for the club to fill in the terms afterwards. The Brazil is starting to grow. If you get an education, there are secure jobs available in the civil service and so on. And Pelé's mum really didn't want him to be a footballer. In order to overcome that resistance, he has to show that he's going to give it everything. And part of giving it everything is the fear of it not turning out right, the fear of poverty. I think that Pelé will probably go to his grave still incapable of feeling financially secure. That's the harm that child poverty does to a soul, I think. You put those two together, the pride and the fear, coupled with the athletic virtues that he's been born with, and you get almost the perfect footballing machine.
I mean, do you have any explanation for why he seems to be so far ahead of everybody when you look at footage of the time? I mean, there's the 1958 final footage. People might be familiar with this, even if they haven't seen the film. There's the first goal scored by Sweden, Nils Liedholm. And honestly, the goal looks like something out of a journalist's match that you might see before, like a final of some kind. It's just, you're kind of saying this guy. And Liedholm, I think, was one of the top strikers in Serie A at the time. It did seem as though he was kind of playing football from the future, very much in that period.
I agree. If you really want to see it, well, he says it's his best game, and it's the best I've ever seen from him. The final of the old Intercontinental Cup, the champions of Europe and South America, against Benfica at the end of 62, when he's absolutely in his pomp. He's filled out more for that skinny kid in the 58 World Cup. And Santos of Brazil have narrowly won the first leg in Brazil 3-2. Benfica are favourites back on home ground. And Pelé puts Santos 5-0 up, you know, either scoring or making goals. And he's charging through great defenders as if he's like from another species. It's like, is it Brian Glover in Kez, you know, when he's a school teacher charging through these little kids, you know, saying, pretending to be Bobby Charlton. Part of it, I think, is that he and again, motivated by pride, but also by fear. You can't take the fear out of the equation, because that's the thing that keeps on pushing him forward. He's in a physical condition which is far, far superior to those around him. And he looks like a player from the future, because he's faster, he's fitter, he's quicker. He's worked out all of the techniques. He's applied his mind, even his breathing, to how he controls the ball on the chest. He's worked that out on his own. If he has a certain breathing pattern, it'll be easier to control the ball. He is absolutely driven and absolutely dedicated, because he's spurred on by excesses of pride and excesses of fear.
Well, what do you think? What effect do you think fear then had on his behavior? I mean, okay, one of the themes of the film, certainly the second half of the film, is it kind of traces how Pelé is sort of rising with Brazil in these great years of this late democracy, 58 to 64, where things seem to be going well in general in the country. He's kind of the symbol of this rising country, you know, young and strong and successful, and everyone's having a great time. Then there's a military coup and things start to get a little bit darker, but not for Pelé, who continues to be, you know, the toast of the nation, the best footballer in the world, hailed by everybody, kind of cozied up to, certainly he's cozied up to by the regime. But one of the there are people in this film who criticize him for, well, basically say Pelé could have done more, you know, I mean, because he was unaffected by this, and he says himself that life didn't really change much for me, that he turned a blind eye, that he could have stood up to be something more than what he was, and that he let Brazil down by his behavior. I mean, you know, there's a lot to talk about with this, I think, because there's a lot said about this, which I find difficult to really take at face value. But I just wondered what your initial thoughts are on his behavior. Should he have been more of a kind of counter-regime figure?
The military government that took over in 64 took over with, and it's something that subsequently people didn't like to remember, but it took over with a lot of popularity. A lot has been made of a student demonstration against the military government at the end of the 60s that had 100,000 out, you know, a march of 100,000. Back in 64, you know, when the military took over, the right wing were able to put a million people on the streets. There was mass support for the military government, which certainly at the start was not especially hardline. There was a project there of national development. And the early years of the military government are still seen in Brazil as the economic miracle. It was a time when economically the country was developing. Now, that development, it was a short-lived process, because it concentrated the wealth too much. The wealth wasn't spread sufficiently for that development to be sustainable. But certainly for a while, there is still a feel-good factor in Brazil. The Brazilian military dictatorship, it goes hard line towards the end of the 60s, but it didn't start off hard line. And it's a much softer military dictatorship than, say, Argentina or Chile. Much softer. When the Argentine military dictatorship killed 30,000 The Brazilian maybe 3,000 top whack. They're different societies. So certainly at the start of the process, I don't think that people were necessarily looking to Pelé to be against the government. It's very tricky, this, because he bowed out of the World Cup in 1970. He could, 74, they really wanted him to play and he didn't. From a safe distance, years afterwards, he said that he didn't play 74 in protest against the military government. Now, he said this at a time when the military government was being looked back on in hindsight as a bad thing. I don't think there is any truth in his claim. I went in depth with this with Mario Zagallo, who was the coach in 70 and 74, and with Tostão, who was the centre forward who played with him in 70. And both of them gave different explanations. Tostão said that it was all about his legacy. He wanted to leave the stage at a high point, which would have been 70. In 74, he wouldn't have been as good, and he didn't want that to be his legacy. And Zagallo stressed the fact that he'd signed a deal with an American soft drink company. He was making his money that way. Yeah. I've never spoken to him. There was only once, because in most of his interviews over the years has been PR. He's been coaxed into doing this. It took months to get him to do this interview, because I think he knows that the questions asked about his political role will, when he's gone, those questions will still be hanging around. So at least he's tried to answer them. He's tried to have some control over his own narrative. But there was once when I tried to interview him, this is in the mid-90s when he was Brazil's sports minister, and he'd just given an interview saying that at his heyday, he could have done more for footballers, for Brazilian footballers. And I wanted to use that as a way in to saying, well, what more could you have done? What do you regret? But at the time, they would only offer me that if I went to New York and I didn't have money to cross the other side of the city. So that project died. And then when he stopped being sports minister, he obviously wasn't going to leave himself open to those kind of lines of questioning. But that's obviously a doubt that he has in his own mind, what he could have done for Brazilian footballers in terms of freedom of contract and so on. I actually don't think there are big doubts in his mind of what he could have done for Brazilian society. In that sense, I think he might well be right. I mean, maybe we ask for too much for our sportsmen. And if you look at the situation of Brazil, in comparison, say, with the United States, because his obvious contemporary there is Ali. Yeah. And part of this is the differences between Brazil and the United States, because Ali grows in an environment when you know exactly who is white and who is black, who is being discriminated and who isn't. Brazil is a little bit more complicated. You know, there's much more of a racial mix, which means it's more difficult to organize. You know, who is black and who is white? Well, it kind of depends on social circumstances. And the other thing is, you know, the US as an imperial power was sending its poor young black kids to Vietnam, you know, so there's another thing against which to organize. That wasn't quite so clear cut in Brazil. And so you're asking him for a level of political sophistication, which I don't think you should be looking for sports stars to provide.
Yeah. And he seems to have come to the conclusion that, look, winning the 1970 World Cup was kind of me doing my bit. Juca Kafuri, the sports writer, is in this. He draws a comparison with Ali as well, and he says, "Well, the difference with Muhammad Ali is that he knew that he would be arrested, but also that he wouldn't be mistreated or maybe killed. But Pelé didn't have this guarantee. I mean, does that seem realistic to you?"
No, and Juca Kafuri, they were close. And no, I don't think there was any risk perhaps he may have not been allowed to stay in Brazil, and had he made very, very outspoken outspoken statements, which I don't think were necessarily his views at the time anyway. But no, I don't think there was any risk. I mean, from a public relations point of view, and had the Brazilian government mistreated someone with the worldwide fame of Pelé, someone who was so useful to them. I mean, it is striking that the two moments at which the black Brazilian has been most important to the national identity come under the most authoritarian governments. There's the dictatorship, kind of a non-militaristic version of Mussolini, of Getúlio Vargas in the 1930s, where the samba musicians became, from being police targets, they became national heroes. And then in the late 60s and 1970, Pelé becomes like a national hero for the 1970 World Cup. It is strange. It's a contradiction that I've never really fully been able to understand.
Well, there's one of the harshest things that's said about him in this film is by Paulo Cesar Lima, I think, Caju, who says, you know, that he disappointed me because when I looked at him, I saw a black person who just accepts everything, who only ever says yes, sir, who's submissive, who doesn't answer back, question or judge. And this is Caju saying, you know, he thought... This is him saying how disappointed he is that Pelé was just going along with like these generals without, he never kicked up any. And I thought, this strikes me as very unfair to kind of racialize his acquiescence. You know, I don't know if Mario Zagallo gets all this kind of the same type of stuff thrown at him for what I have no doubt was his own accommodation with, like, ultimately, you know, it's not like these people have any control over who's running the country. Pelé said something like, he has a line in this, which he's asked quite directly, did you know what was going on? I mean, and when they say, when we know what was going on, they're referring here to the fact that this is a regime that had killed people, that had sort of falsely imprisoned people, or imprisoned people without trial, without charge, was doing, there was a lot of these types of abuses. Did you know what was happening? And he says, effectively, it would be a lie to say I didn't know there was some stuff going on. So yeah, I did know that bad things were happening, but we didn't really know either what's true, what's false, what exactly is going on. We didn't really know. You hear things, but it's like, you can't be sure. We're playing football the whole time. And that just seemed to me like quite a, rather than a cop-out, it actually sounded like quite a plausible description of life under a dictatorship.
Yeah, and remember that it's not the Argentina dictatorship or the Chilean dictatorship, which set out to eliminate working class organizations. The Brazil one wasn't like that. At its worst, the late 60s, early 70s, a lot of the targets are the middle class intelligentsia. Now they're not naturally people that Pelé is at home with. Mm. Paulo César Caju, who is a terrific figure. I've had the pleasure of meeting him on a number of occasions. He's, first of all, he's 10 years younger. So, you know, he's grown up with, he's seen the 60s, you know, and the protests from the United States at a formative time in his life. But he's not from up country in Minas Gerais and then up country in São Paulo and in Santos. He's grown up kind of favelas of Rio, which through the geography of Rio means there's a proximity between him and the middle class intelligentsia. He started moving in those circles, and he got his political education in those circles. So his perspective, I think, is very different from that of Pelé's, just because the circumstances of their upbringing and their generations are very, very different. In terms of the race issue, I think Pelé could have done more. But to put too much on him is, I think, the dangers of getting into some kind of Superman complex, you know, where some kind of Superman has to solve society's problems. Mm. And that I think is not healthy for anyone.
Yeah, I mean, another interesting part of this film, it left me with a different impression of a story that I had previously evidently missed big, great chunks of, which is João Saldanha, the manager of Brazil, or the coach of Brazil before the 1970 World Cup, who was replaced by Mario Zagallo in the, you know, in the lead up to the tournament. And in whatever version of the story I had heard, this Saldanha was a somewhat tragic and hard done by figure who essentially had been kind of booted out of his role because he was, I guess actually a journalist, a kind of a leftist journalist, sort of a skinny chain smoking guy who seemed quite charming, spoke great, gave great interviews in English, which is always good for your international reputation, I guess. And that the generals just hadn't liked this guy. They couldn't control him. They didn't like him. And they got him out of there. What this film is saying is that, no, he hated Pelé, was spreading lies about him, wanted to drop him from the World Cup. And everybody else was like, actually, João, why don't you go instead?
Well, both are true to an extent. There's someone here behind the scenes who gets a very, very bad name. Well, there's a lot you can throw at him, but he was a bright cookie. And that's João Havelange, who before he became FIFA president was president of Brazil's Football Association, started just before the 1958 World Cup. Now, that's very significant. Now, Havelange, it was a stroke of genius from Havelange to appoint João Saldanha. I shall explain why. Brazilian football had, it was developing, and it was no more dominated solely by Rio and São Paulo. You've also got two other sub-centres, Porto Alegre and Belo Horizonte. And that means that you've suddenly, and remember, all the players play at home at this time, you've suddenly got many more regions all fighting to have their players in the national team. It becomes chaos. And so he appoints Saldanha because Saldanha is a man who very, very charismatic, who knows his own mind. And in his very first press conference, Saldanha says, This is my first 11, blah, 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 blah. These are my substitutes, blah, 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 blah. Kills all of that political infighting and all of those discussions. You've gone with a coach who knows his mind, who knows his team, who's just not going to accept all of the political infighting. And that was good enough to get them through qualification and through to the World Cup. But he's unstable, Saldanha. And the way that they played during qualification, which was a very, very open 4-2-4, there's no way that they would have won the World Cup that way. And so it was the right decision to get rid of him as well. But one of the things which is happening with this is he has fallen out badly with Pelé. Now, this is something which became forgotten very quickly in Brazilian culture right after Mexico 70 for obvious reasons. Saldanha was clearly not convinced that Pelé could play the World Cup. He started talking about Pelé losing vision, being short-sighted or so on. But he had some backup. Aimoré Moreira, who'd been the coach in 62, was writing articles saying Pelé has to be dropped from the team. So there was a current of opinion against this. Now, there probably was a political dimension to Saldanha being sacked, and that Brazilian national team in Mexico 70 were very, very military. The fellow who became the coach subsequent to 74, Claudio Coutinho, was a military man. I don't think they would have been happy with the idea of a loudmouth communist, which Saldanha was, being coach of the national team during the World Cup. But there were solid footballing reasons to get rid of him. I think it was a stroke of genius to appoint him and a stroke of genius to get rid of him.
Yeah, I mean, you know, when you see how Pelé ultimately performs in the World Cup, I mean, okay, it's not like we're seeing this for the first time. You do think, the generals weren't wrong about everything. It was actually important to have this guy involved. But I found the presentation of this 1970 World Cup, which is the climax of the film, it was sort of interesting the way they left out the whole America part of Pelé's career, which to me is, I would have liked to see, but I guess it's always difficult to get the footage together for these types of documentaries, and 1970 is a good climactic point. But just how kind of solemn the whole thing is at the end, like there's this kind of almost funereal music. It's like almost a sad moment of like he has completed it, but like he's so kind of wrecked. So he talks about the thing that you get is not the trophy, it's the relief. That's the real prize, just the sheer relief of oh, we didn't lose, you know, like as though if you ever really want to be that good, one of the prices that you have to pay is that you can't actually enjoy a minute of it.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's especially true in Brazil, where there's only two things that can happen in a World Cup: Brazil win or Brazil lose. That's the way they talk about World Cups. You know, that one we won, that one we lost. There's only two possible results. So the pressure was really on. And the pressure was really on for him, because he saw that tournament as his defining moment. He is past his best. If you want to see the best Pelé, look at around 62, 63. And he's bulked up by 1970. He can't. Pelé at his absolute best. And the comparison with the way that Pelé runs with the ball and Maradona runs with the ball, I think is wonderful, because for Maradona, the ball is tied to his left foot. For Pelé, I often think of the ball as kind of bouncing alongside him like a happy, obedient puppy. But when he was surging through, and I watch him against Benfica in at the end of 62, you know, it's like watching someone from a different species. He doesn't quite have that in 1970, but he's got other things as well. I mean, sometimes it's the genius of simplicity. The pass that he gives to Jairzinho for the goal against England, which effectively is the goal that wins the World Cup. So many of that team have told me that.
Well, you would say that, Tim. That is a great moment in the film, though. Just the way that they do that is beautiful. They sort of freeze it just at the moment that Pelé controls the ball, and you can sort of see there's three English defenders who are all about to be taken out of the game here by this little pass into space. It's brilliantly done.
It's the simplicity of genius. The little pass for Carlos Alberto for the fourth goal against Italy in the final. Again, it's the simplicity of genius. And some of the things that are most remembered from that World Cup are goals that he didn't score. You know, yeah. The dribble around the Uruguayan goalkeeper or the attempt to score from the halfway line in the first game against Czechoslovakia, which Zagallo said to me that he thought that Pelé trying to score from his own half was a response to Saldanha saying that he was short-sighted.
You can't see.
Yeah. Yeah. I put that one to Tostão as well, and he said that's ridiculous. But that was what Zagallo said.
Hmm. Yeah. Is he the greatest of all time for you? I mean, I keep seeing, Tim, over the last little while, that Cristiano Ronaldo has apparently broken the all-time goal-scoring record and it's 750, 760 something. This closes with... you know, Pelé scored 1,283 goals in 1,367 games. It seems like Ronaldo's actually got a long way to go.
Yeah, but I don't like that. I mean, Pelé has used that himself against Messi. You know, when you've scored 1,000 goals, come back and we'll talk. You know, I think that's a very poor grounds on which to base his claim. The greats are not about statistical accumulation. And Pelé, a lot of his games were friendlies. You know, I mean, you got to remember this is the days before TV. And there were times during his career that Brazilian TV is showing games for free, you know, showing games for free, not paying any money for it. So in Santos, they abandon South America's Champions League, the Copa Libertadores, just because it's financially, it's suicide. You know, you've got to travel all the way to another country for one game. There's no TV revenue. And what makes economic sense in that situation? If you're going to travel, then let's pack in four or five games in the same country. And we'll make our money that way. So there's a lot. They did become a Santos. They did become the Harlem Globetrotters. So the greatness of Pelé, to see it in this kind of statistical accumulation, I think is a very, very weak argument. The greatness of Pelé is in the big games. And time again, when it really matters, he rises to the occasion, and he's absolutely fantastic. I dislike these arguments about who's the greatest ever, because they always become attritional. And I believe that these players are to be appreciated, you know, that they belong to all of us, and let's enjoy them more than argue about them. I wander sometimes between the big three for me, which are Pelé, Maradona, and Di Stefano. Di Stefano for me is the most influential in the development of the game. Maradona, I've never seen anything before or since like the heights that Maradona hit in the 1986 World Cup. But Pelé, over the course of so many years, when it really mattered, was so exceptionally brilliant that he is, at the moment, I'm probably going for Pelé. But so if you ask me this time next month, I might have a different answer.
That's the second time he's gone off.
They never go home, those boys.
The second captain's
world service.
It is not war and death and famine, it's not that at all. It's the opposite of that, it's to persuade there's a world outside of that. That's why sport's important.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.